I'm Ed Levine. This episode of Special Sauce is being brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company, publisher of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, written by Stella Parks, Serious Eats' very own pastry wizard. In Brave Tart, Stella shares foolproof recipes for classic American desserts. Think sugar cookies, animal crackers, candy bars, and frosted yellow cake. With a historian's rigor and a scientist's curiosity, Stella documents the intriguing stories of how our favorite sweets came to be, and this is key, and the best methods for recreating these classics at home. As someone who has had the not-so-difficult task of tasting many of the treats Stella was developing for her book, I can personally attest to their serious deliciousness. So, if you want to delight your family and friends with homemade versions of the sweets we all grew up with, pick up a copy of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, wherever books are sold. Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
To speak of Southern culture, for the longest time, too many people heard white Southern culture when they heard that, or they heard Confederate grounded Southern culture. And the reality is the South is as black as it is white. And if anything, the imprint of black peoples on the region and on its food and on its music is actually primary, not secondary. Once you embrace that, a world of tolerance opens, a world of inclusivity opens. But we need to get there.
We're back with my friend John T. Edge, and we're going to talk about the Potlucker Papers. John T. is the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi, written or edited more than a dozen books, none more impressive than his new book, The Potlucker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. The Potlucker Papers is a remarkable book. It's unbelievably ambitious and far-reaching because it's a food history of the modern South spanning 60 years starting in 55 with the African-American cooks whose food fueled the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott and going all the way to the present day. I mean, that's not a short swath of time, you know.
No.
How did the book come about?
There are a bunch of different ways to answer that. The best way I can answer it right now is that, you know, I've been writing about and obsessing over Southern food for 20 plus years now. And I wanted to figure out why. You know, I mean, what is it other than the fact that I love to eat barbecue or, you know, I love the crunchy savor of fried chicken? Why am I obsessed about it? And the thing I realized is it's the narratives embedded in the food, the stories we tell about food are the things that drive my interest. So if I recognize that, then what stories are most resonant? What are the stories I need to tell? And when do I begin that? And I recognize that the South I know began to change in 55. The Montgomery bus boycotts are arguably the beginnings of the modern civil rights movement. You see black resistance. You see white resistance to that drive. You see a South fitfully becoming something new and different. And when I found this character, Georgia Gilmore, who had been a midwife, had literally laid track on the railroad and had been a cook in Montgomery and had raised money for the bus boycotts by baking cakes and pies and frying chicken. When I found that character, when I recognized that woman could be the beginning of a book about Southern food and that she stepped into the frame in 1955, I knew I had forward propulsion.
Interesting. It must have given shape to the narrative.
It did. It gave me a way because I see linkages today to food as politics discussions today. You know, it gave me a way to link 2015 and 55 because I see them very much in conversation with one another. And I wanted to make that clear to folks that in 55, food was a political discussion worth having, and 2015 offers the same.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Southern Belly was still first and foremost about deliciousness. And then in the ensuing years at SFA, I think your thinking and the pleasures you derive from food became something more than just sheer deliciousness.
Food offered me a way to think through my belief in this place, my anger in this place being the South. that's always been the issue for me and for many Southerners. You know, it's Faulknerian in its roots. Like, you love this place, you loathe this place. How do you resolve?
Yeah, you do have this incredible quote in the book from the late, great Edna Lewis that I thought you could have written. You know, she said, "For me, the South is not just food. It is beauty, love, hate, art, poetry, and hard work. I love what is good about it. It is what makes us who we are." That sort of sums up your attitude about the South, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, who better than Edna Lewis to bring those words to us? Edna Lewis, the granddaughter of freed slaves. Edna Lewis, who in the 1970s, by way of her writing, is preaching a return to agriculture, a return to the possibilities of the farm in the South. A black woman whose forebears had been enslaved by the land is now claiming possibilities for the land.
Did you go into the book thinking that there were rays of hope, or did they reveal themselves to you?
That's a great question. And when people say that, that's a great question. It's always because they're stalling and trying to figure out what quite to say. But the South has changed over the period of this book, 60 years, briskly. You know, the propulsive nature of that change is the stunning, you know, to think about where the South was in 1955 and to think about where we are today. It's remarkable. If you spend 3 years of your life kind of parsing out Southern history through food, you recognize that the arc is going in the right direction. You recognize, as Dr. King would have it, and you recognize how briskly things have changed. I also recognized while writing this book that Southerners have told stories about their region over the last century that have in many ways limited this place. The Southerners told stories that are kind of Moonlight Magnolias, blather and bullshit that have limited this place. And that I, as a writer in 2017, have the opportunity to frame new narratives that privilege certain stories, and I shape a perception of the South to come. And so I'm an optimist and a bit of a propagandist at the same time, and I recognize that role because I recognize that so much horrific propaganda limited this place before. I'm trying to right the scales a bit and do it in as clear-eyed a way as possible.
Yeah.
Does that make any damn sense?
Yeah, that does. No, it really makes sense. I want to talk about just like a few of the individual chapters that I was so taken by. First of all, you talk about chefs connecting to indigenous ingredients, mm-hmm. you know, and like Sean Brock and, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And then you also talk about people like Anson Mills, mm-hmm. who, you know, was the first artisanal grits purveyor, maker. And you talk about the role that home cooks played and the role that Southern television cooks mm-hmm. played. And there's just so many things that you connected dots in ways that I certainly wouldn't, because I don't know as much about this and I haven't spent years writing about it the way you have. But talk a little bit about some of those things, you know, and there was that great chapter on barbecue, which is always interested both of us in terms of race and class and all that.
I mean, we start with the chapter about home cooks and kind of the devaluing of home cooking that came with the women's liberation movement. It was a moment when it was said to women, you know, you are now free, go depart the kitchen, go earn your living elsewhere. And one person whom I think offered a counter-narrative was Natalie Dupree. Natalie, who had risen to fame while running a cooking school in Atlanta, in Rich's department store down in the basement. Natalie rose to fame in the 1980s while directing that cooking school, while also in that same period writing a book called New Southern Cooking. A TV show comes out of that, and through those various enterprises, she calls a generation of white Southern women back to the kitchen and says, like, what you learned with your grandmother and your mother in the kitchen is worthwhile. It's leverageable. It might be your career for the future. And, you know, I ended up spending about 5 days digging through her archive, literally pasteboard boxes out on a carport somewhere. in actually somewhere, suburban Atlanta, and to sift through those documents from Natalie Dupree's archive, you know, was to see this bold woman in that time. And I realized myself as a white male writing, I'd underestimated her impact. And I think it was skewed by my own gender and hubris.
Yeah.
It was a hell of a thing to recognize, though, going through those pasteboard boxes.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about this before we came before the mics, but, you know, it seems like as a white male writing about Southern food and mm-hmm. African American culture, you're going to open yourself up in this age of social media and just a lot of people right. thinking about these things to various charges.
I mean, I recognize that, you know, because I direct an organization that from its inception, the Southern Food Alliance from its inception, has said that we're going to work towards welcome table ideals. We're going to pay down debts of pleasure to African-American cooks who have never gotten their due. And that's been the MO from the beginning at the Southern Foodways Alliance. And then with my own writing, I have fitfully, yes, but attempted to do similar work through my own writing. So if you pronounce that for the organization for which you work, and then you hope for that by way of your own writing, you bear a bigger burden. You bear a bigger responsibility. So, you know, criticism I might get, I've set myself up for, because I it's like, you know, guilty white man of the South. And I say that a little flippantly, but self-aware, self-conscious white Southerner, I have to address that. I have to have command of that dialogue. And when criticism comes, I welcome it and embrace it and listen as best I can, argue back when I feel it's unfair, but listen as closely as I can.
And sometimes there was that quote in the Times, it's like, you know, where your wife says, just be open, and you say that doesn't come easily. And I think it doesn't come easily to a lot of people like us who are missionaries in our own way, you know. And you are a propagandist in the same way that I'm a propagandist in a certain way. And that comes with the territory. And being a propagandist in 2017 leaves you open. And in a way, it's sort of a red badge of courage.
Well, I mean, you know, you could substitute the word storyteller for propagandist and get the same place, right? So I'm telling newer stories about the American South, about the place from which I come, the place I love, the place that makes me angry. And, you know, my choice in stories is up for debate.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I was going to write a chapter about our Middle Tennessee whole hog weekend barbecue adventure. The first sentence, I dug it up. I don't know where I found this.
What year was that that we traveled, Ed? Was that 99?
Yeah,
like that?
I want to say 98 or 99. I said, my pal John T. Edge is equal parts salesman, writer, and academic. And I don't think that's criticism. I think that's, you know, I think that's a reasonable thing. And by the way, when you are equal parts salesman, writer, and academic, you are going to open yourself up.
You could also substitute the word activist for salesman. You know, this prosecution of ideas, this belief that you can affect change. And I believe I can affect change by way of the stories I choose to tell about this region. We've told limiting stories, stories that sent us toward the ditch before. I'm choosing to tell new stories, and I'm, you know, pretty damn excited about them.
Yeah. And I love the chapter on barbecue because the guy who owns Charlie Virgo's Rendezvous Room mm-hmm. saying that he admits that, you know, he was just serving a version of an African-American food tradition. Mm-hmm. And one thing that you didn't go into, because I guess it would have just taken you on a detour that would have caused the book to be 500 pages longer, is what I thought, as someone who spent many years in black music as an advocate, that everything you say about Southern food applies to music.
Sure it does.
The same way that we were talking about Elvis Presley. Jazz musicians always talk about they created this out of whole cloth and then white people popularized it. That's a tradition that's true in music as it is in food.
It's really hard because to speak of Southern culture, for the longest time, too many people heard white Southern culture when they heard that, or they heard Confederate grounded Southern culture. And the reality is the South is as black as it is white. You know, and if anything, the imprint of black peoples on the region and on its food and on its music is actually primary, not secondary. And once you recognize that, once you embrace that, a world of possibilities opens, a world of tolerance opens, a world of inclusivity opens. But we need to get there. We need to recognize that that imprint of black peoples on the American South has its basis in slavery.
Exactly. It's this combination that you, at least I always grapple with in music and food. It's a collision of generosity of spirit and bitterness.
That bitterness, I mean, you know, the second chapter opens with a lunch counter scene, a photograph, a horrific photograph from 1963 of Woolworth's in Jackson, Mississippi. And you see activists at the counter pelted with salt and mustard and ketchup. And you see an angry, angry young white crowd. There's deep and profound bitterness in this book because the South has been a place of terror as well as triumph.
But one of the things that I got through after rereading it is that if you had to write it today, it would be a little different. Yes, it's history, but it takes you up to the present day. And so is your thinking constantly evolving?
No, it's not. I mean, I'm glad I got to cut this off in 2015. This is not a moment of making sense. This is a moment of observation and maybe a little bit of reflection and a lot of activism. I choose to believe that Trump is an aberration, and I see 2015 as a great place to end this book because I see multiculturalism, a true kind of demographic destiny for the South and for America on the horizon. And I don't think that will be eclipsed by this brief visitation of ugliness.
And you actually end the book with something that turns out, I just found out, that you first experienced with your dad.
Yeah.
You know, which is a South that's not just about the collision of African American and white cultures, but it's Chicanos and it's Latin Americans and it's South Asians. And talk a little bit about that, you know.
I mean, you know, for the longest time, people have tended to frame the South as a bunker of tradition. You know, this place that was a stronghold against encroachment of new things, new peoples, new ideas. And that's just not true. It never has been true, and it's certainly not true today. So to apprehend Southern cuisine today is to travel to Houston, which, you know, I think of as kind of the 21st century Creole city of the South. If New Orleans was the 19th and 20th century Creole city, the small C Creole city of the South, Houston is the 21st century Creole city of the South. And to sit down at a place like Crawfish and Noodles or various other restaurants in Houston where they're Vietnamese owned and they're doing Cajun style crawfish.
Crawfish etouffee banh mi.
Right. Or, you know, I had my favorite thing I had recently in Houston was a pile of fries covered with turkey meat that had been pulled from the bone, same turkey neck meat that you would have cooked crawfish in a liquid that had been bobbing with turkey necks. So they'd cook the crawfish in a liquid bobbing with turkey necks, pull the turkey necks out, pull the meat from the turkey necks, pile that on top of fries, and it was like, you know, here's your Cajun fries, all done by Vietnamese American immigrants.
Yes.
Who are interpreting the South, who are, you know, we talk about cultural appropriation. Here are Vietnamese folk appropriating the tropes of the American South and of Cajun peoples, refashioning them and creating something anew. That's the future of the South.
Yeah. It's so fascinating. And of course, one of the first times I discovered that was visiting our mutual friend, Rob Walsh.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
me too.
Who's one of the first people that really turned us all on to.
Oh, completely.
You know, like, well, you got to come down here because Houston is unlike any other city in the country.
Now, if you turn to the back of my book, and I hope you get to the back of my book.
I have.
But you'll see, like, a thanks to Rob, because those ideas about a multicultural South were very much gestated in Rob's car, in Rob's Jetta, driving around Houston, looking curious. You know, conversations with him where he'd say, like, now, do you know where tacos al pastor come from?
Yeah.
Well,
Exactly. And Rob is, of course, a great Texas-based food writer, now lives in Galveston, wrote the one of the definitive books on Texas barbecue, on Tex-Mex food, Texas food in general. And he's opened up so many people's eyes to the nature of food in Houston and Texas in general, and also through some of the same prisms that we look at food.
You know,
I think he's somebody who doesn't, even though he's written a lot of books and he's done fine, we should give a shout out to Rob because
I deeply respect him and find his curiosity just beautiful. And he really did show me, along with my father, who, you know, took me up and down Buford Highway, that connection comes right back to Rob, too, of saying, look at your South. Your South is not this land merely of black and white. Your South is multi-hued and beautiful. Embrace it.
Has the Poliker Papers affected how you're teaching and what you're teaching?
Well, I teach not at the University of Mississippi, but at the University of Georgia.
Yep.
So I teach in the MFA program there through the journalism school. And the students who are attracted to that program are mid-career journalists, many of whom are finding ways out of newspapers or beginning to write books. And so, you know, they've kind of, especially the first cohort of students, have lived through this book with me. So I look forward to returning to our next residency and talking through it with them. You know, as far as how I teach and what I see, I'm far more interested in kind of the end of this book, the kind of multicultural horizon right now. And I think it does come back to this kind of want on my part to prosecute an idea that the South truly is realizing its potential now. It is diversifying. There's backsliding going on. There's backsliding going on all across the country. But when I look at the stories that captivate me today, and I look at the stories that captivate my colleagues at the University of Georgia, these are multicultural stories of an emergent South that is as much about Korean and Vietnamese and Laotian and Mexican and Lebanese narratives as it is about, you know, pasty white people like me.
Right. And yet you do acknowledge, and you have to acknowledge, that all those peoples and ethnic groups have not suffered from the same experiences that African Americans have had.
It remains central to the Southern narrative. Of course it does.
You know, and so you're not saying that it's the same thing to be a South Indian in the South as it is to be an African American.
I'm not, but I am saying that people of color have been historically mistreated in the South and are being mistreated and disrespected and devalued today. And there's work to be done on that frontier as well. But the deepest root cause of trouble and discord in the American South is racism against people of African descent.
Yes, yeah, for sure. I want to ask you one more thing that I wanted to talk about in the book, which I thought was so interesting, was your depiction of the tomato pickers in Florida. And talk a little bit about that.
I mean, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, I think, is one of the boldest civil rights groups of recent years. What the coalition did was, upon recognizing the horrific conditions in South Central Florida, where the great majority of our winter tomato crop is picked, and wherein, until very recently, workers toiled in horrific conditions for way too small a rate of pay, the coalition came up with a campaign, a fair food campaign, that basically said, you know, if we can, and the pickers are working piece rate, like, so they're going through the fields, picking buckets of tomatoes, throwing them back in the hopper, and they're paid based on the weight for each bucket. And the coalition basically said, let's come up with a campaign that puts pressure not on consumers, but puts pressure on retailers, grocery stores, puts pressure on retailers, fast food. And if we can get them to just pay one more penny per pound for the tomatoes these workers are picking, coursing through the fields of Central Florida, then we can lift these workers out of penury, out of poverty. And what sorry SOB wouldn't pay one more penny per pound? Turns out quite a few sorry SOBs wouldn't pay.
It took them a while.
Penny. It did. But they, I mean, they took this argument to the streets. They engaged in old-fashioned protest and boycott and brought down Taco Bell. Yum Corporation, which owns Taco Bell, caved to the demands. McDonald's.
Walmart
steps in and says, So the thing that's interesting about that is it is an American problem with a solution isolated in the American South in Florida, and ultimately embraced by the most powerful retailer on the continent in this moment, another Southern company based out of Arkansas. And the Coalition of Immokalee Workers set the standard for future kind of civil rights agitation, but we don't think about it as a Southern thing. Like, mm-hmm. think about it. This was a problem identified in the South, a solution identified and prosecuted in the South, and then ultimately the affirmation of that solution comes with the ultimate buy-in of Walmart, another Southern company.
For sure. All right, so now it's time for the special sauce, all-you-can-answer buffet, John T. No pressure. No pressure. Really, don't worry about it. You know, who's at your last supper? No family allowed.
Eugene Walter, native of Mobile, Alabama, the man for whom we named our cat, and who was one of the first editors on the first editorial team of the Paris Review, lived in Rome for the longest time alongside Leontine Price, wrote beautifully about Southern identity, called Mobile, Alabama, Sweet Lunacy's County Seat. Lyrical, beautiful writer, wrote beautifully late in his career about food as well.
Right. Could be. All right. So who else? Does the three other seats?
Three
could
other
be musicians,
seats.
Could be living, dead, mm-hmm. could be artists, mm-hmm. could be anybody.
Randy Newman.
All right.
I would like to have dinner with Randy Newman very much. Randy Newman, if you're listening, I really want to sit down. I think his album Good Old Boys is an American classic that tries to plumb the heart of white identity in the American South through that first song, Rednecks. You know, it begins with Lester Maddox on the TV show. That song, like, resonates with me in a huge kind of way.
Edna Lewis, maybe?
Thelonious Monk.
Thelonious Monk. You're the second person. That's the greatest answer ever because, you know, Thelonious Monk was not only brilliant, but, you know, he once said, it's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't play. And I love that so much about
It's editing, man.
Yeah, exactly.
He also, when he played New York, you know this too, would wear a collared leaf in his lapel to pronounce his North Carolina roots. So I'll take a seat for him. And let's see. Edna Lewis is too easy.
You mean it's because it's too expected, but she is amazing.
She is. I mean, I knew her a little,
right.
though. I mean, I'd like to retrieve somebody from some
All
other
right.
past.
All right.
Zora Neale Hurston.
Zora Neale Hurston.
Folklorist, Barnard-trained folklorist.
African-American,
spent time in the turpentine camps of South Georgia and Florida, documented folk life in the most splendid sort of way, from whom I borrow the term when something's really just kind of busted up and not worth anything. I refer to that thing, that person as butt sprung. I borrow that from Zora Neale Hurston. beautiful book. Their Eyes Were Watching God, a novel that I'd greatly admire. There's a biography of her life by my friend and colleague Valerie Boyd called Wrapped in Rainbows. I would love to have dinner with Miss Hurston.
All right. That's excellent. So what are you eating?
What am I eating?
Yeah. What are you eating?
Oh, at dinner.
Yeah,
at dinner.
It's no coffee klatch.
There's a recipe on our wall. My cousin gave me a framed copy of it. It's my mother's catfish stew. And it was her father's before that. They had a place on the Edisto River just outside of Orangeburg, South Carolina. My wife makes that catfish stew today. She borrows a bit from Scott Peacock and Edna Lewis's book, The Gift of Southern Cooking, and we eat a merger of that. So it's catfish stew with a bowl of rice and some greens that have been cooked down, not with pork, but with fish sauce.
Got it. I like it. Dessert?
Dessert. I like cheese. I'm not a big dessert boy. I like the Green Hill cheese from Sweetgrass Dairy.
Yeah, Sweetgrass Dairy, which is a Georgian.
South Georgia.
Yeah.
They were one of the first into the artisan world, and that cheese remains one of my favorites.
Those cheeses they make are awesome.
They're remarkable.
Yeah, they are awesome.
So that and some whiskey.
You know, you didn't even have to say that. I just would have put that in. I would have put that in post.
Although I actually drink more rum these days than whiskey. Yeah, I can afford rum. The varieties, there's much to learn. I'm a little weary of the kind of merchandising of whiskey by way of narrative.
Yeah.
The narrative boy is.
So what do you cook? And I know probably you cook as often as Blair does.
She's a far better cook and a more regular cook than I.
So what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
I cook a lot of beans. I love kind of the transformative nature of beans. You know, these dry pebbles become this luxurious beast by way of hunks of pork and long cooking and spices. I really love to cook beans. We have just a variety of stuff, a lot of Rancho Gordo stuff, like pink-eye peas from them. I've got a lot of Anson Mills stuff in my freezer, too. So Carolina Gold rice from Anson Mills. You know, even though those are, as you say, artisanal goods, they're relatively inexpensive, too.
Right.
It's not like you're buying $50 a pound hunks of Wagyu. So rice and beans are the things I love to cook. I also love to cook pork chops. We've got a really good butcher now in Oxford, Mississippi, and it's called Neon Pig, and they're pulling in local pigs. They're doing it right. I just go in their case and see what they got.
What's, and you may have already answered this, who's the one person that you just dying to sit down and break bread with just to find out how they think and about the world? Again, it could be living your dad. It could be an artist. It could be anybody.
Yeah, Kara Walker. I'm fascinated by her work as an artist.
And talk a little bit about
her. Sure. So Kara Walker spent some of her upbringing in Atlanta, Georgia, was inspired in part by the cyclorama in Atlanta and the depiction of that Battle of Atlanta and one layer applied to the other. A lot of her work is based on domestic scenes. There is cooking going on in her work. There is domestic tension. Almost all of her work addresses racism and its impact. It's profoundly haunting for me as a white man to apprehend Kara Walker's work. And I've had the chance to see it in Louisville, Kentucky, in Houston, Texas, in Atlanta, Georgia, like anywhere I can find her stuff.
But you've never met her?
Never met her. Would love to meet her.
Yeah, fascinating. So it's just been declared John T. Edge Day.
Lord help us all.
What's happening all over the world on that day?
What's happening? Like activities?
Yeah, activities, anything.
People around 2 go out for afternoon cocktails, have a couple, and then they kind of skip through the streets. Not in a kumbaya sort of way, but in just a ridiculously joyful kind of way.
Almost like a second line kind of a way.
Yeah, like I like to drink and skip. I'm quite serious.
So if the world was drinking and skipping on a given day, it'd be great.
It's a good day.
This episode of Special Sauce has been brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company, publisher of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, the first book by resident Serious Eats pastry wizard Stella Parks. The recipes in Brave Tart are awesome, original, and rigorously tested. That's why they really do work. Plus, Stella is so smart, so curious, and such a good writer, you can happily read Brave Tart from cover to cover. I have, like it wasn't a cookbook. It's equal parts science, history, and sweets mythology explained and debunked. I know what you're thinking. As a Serious Eats overlord, I'm hopelessly biased when it comes to Stella. And I probably am. But you too will think she's swell when you get your own copy of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, wherever books are sold. All right, John T., thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us. It's awesome to spend time with you. The only way we get to spend time is if I put a microphone in front of you. So Serious Eaters should pick up a copy of the Pot Liquor Papers immediately, if not sooner. And you should read John T.'s columns in the Oxford American and Garden and Gun. And if you ever get the chance to go to an SFA conference, as I say, it's the best time you can have with your clothes on. So we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters, and thanks, John T.
Thank you, Ed.